this looks unfortunately very formal and way more formal than the talk, but otherwise I can't see. So I want to start by welcoming everybody here. It's great to have people come from various sanghas and from parts of the open source and join us here in Tucson. And I want to thank the leaders locally, Jen and Connie and Robert, for an amazing amount of good work so far. And it's wonderful to have Martha here riding in from out of town to canter for us again. It's been a while. The one thing I would add, maybe by way of sort of a leader's introductions, I think Jen pretty much said this, but I want to second it, is the forms are really here to support us, and we're not here to, you know, fulfill the forms in some abstract way. The practice can sometimes seem pretty rigorous, though I think as a group we're rather accommodating. But one of the strange kind of paradoxes of Zen practice is that slightly formal and demanding aspect very often will lead to stuff that feels very, very soft. So if you think that you're supposed to be all samurai about everything and that it's supposed to be a samurai experience, I really want to discourage you from that view of it. And if things start to get soft and a little blurry or hazy, I think that's great. So it seems like a really big occasion to be here tonight. For many of us from the open source, it's been about 3 years since we've sat a retreat together. And I think for many of us, we're certainly missing our wonderful, important, brilliant teacher, Joan Sutherland Roshi, who's retired from active teaching. I feel both her absence very much tonight and also her presence with us. And I think maybe similar things may be at work for a lot of us in the retreat. I remember Joan used to say about a retreat that for a few days this perfect world really swirls into existence and then it dissolves or disappears. And it's a really precious, as Jen said, and rare opportunity to sit together. Because of that, I think maybe we come to a retreat like this with very strong intentions and aspirations sometimes. And I think that's certainly a good thing, because it is a precious opportunity and practice can be really transformative. At the same time, I think one of the great lessons of a retreat is that you really don't know what's going to happen. And in a funny way for me, that's turned out almost to be one of the most important things about practice, that I'll enter a retreat, I have no idea what I'm getting myself into, I have no idea where it's going to go, and that turns out to be really useful for the rest of my life. I think as much as you can, despite your intentions sometimes, you have to ride the current of the retreat and just discover where it's going to lead you. So I really encourage you to drop your intentions. Emerson says something about dropping them like that. I can't even remember. Drop them immediately and, you know, just go where it leads. If we have to meet things just the way they are, I think it's really important also in a retreat to take ourselves just the way we are, to be ourselves the way we are. One of the teachers in our lineage, Susan Murphy, and we have a zany lineage, so she's an Australian teacher and also a filmmaker and a professor. I remember her at a retreat saying once, if you can't go through the gate just the way you are, you can't go through. And for a moment I thought that meant some people can't go through, but I don't think that's what she meant. I think it's closer to, if you are just as you are, you're through. I think a lot of our westernized forms, and we're relatively westernized, as Martha and Jen both said, are practiced partly in that spirit, to just be ourselves as we practice. Sometimes I remember that taking kind of goofy forms that were very important to me. There was one retreat in Santa Fe where Joan told us that as we walked across the threshold, we should come in and say our names, you know. So it was, hi, I'm Tenny. And it felt a little like the Howdy Doody show or something like that, but I really felt that I walked through the door into the retreat and I wasn't somebody else, I was me. When I first started sitting many years ago, we still wore robes when we sat, and I remember a retreat at the Girl Scout camp in Tucson where for the first time we didn't wear robes, and we were being led on one of the long walks around the wash. And I remember just kind of looking around me, and it would be nice if you know, we were more racially diverse, so that's not the main point, but it was just, you know, it was like a lot of old white people in civvies. And it just, I mean, it seemed really almost sad, but very vulnerable and very tender. It was just people being kind of old who were very sincere in their practice, and they weren't somebody else, and the retreat didn't have to depend on putting on the robes and being all Zen about it. It was just people that I knew or didn't know walking through the wash together, and that was our practice. In a somewhat fiercer mode, I remember David Weinstein, who's now a Roshi, but did his last retreat, I think, as head of practice for Joan in Tucson a long time ago, getting up for encouraging words and just taking the stick and just bashing it on his cushions as hard as he could and just saying, bring all of it. And so that's the spirit with which we sit. There's a great moment, I think not in William Carlos Williams's book-length poem, Patterson, but in his introduction to it. And it's a poem about New Jersey, for God's sakes. And he says that the point of the poem is that we are alive as ourselves, just like the Greeks in Homer's Iliad were alive in that book. And so we're ourselves and we're alive in our retreat and in our encounters with the koans, just as the ancient Chinese worthies were alive in their retreats and their practice with the koans. Doesn't have to be any different from that. So here's a koan, or more properly, a commentary from a koan. And I want to say before I forget that I'll be reading this and one other koan tonight, and both of those are out on the back table by the water in case anybody wants to carry around a copy, and then there'll be more koans the next day or two. So this is from Yuan Wu's commentary to Case 20 of the Blue Cliff Record. He says, haven't you heard? Wu She went to see Shito. It's a very famous, important Shan teacher. He had made an agreement with himself beforehand saying, if there's a court at the first word, I'll stay. Otherwise, I'll go. Shito just sat on his seat. She shook out his sleeves and went out. But apparently, the shaking out your sleeves is a sign of great contempt. You know, you sort of flap your robes and walk out. So Shito just sat in his seat. She shook out his sleeves and went out. Shito knew that Wu She was a vessel of truth, so he had extended his teaching to him. But She hadn't understood his meaning. He had announced his departure and gone out. When he got to the gate, Shito called out to him, Reverend! When She looked back, Shito said, from birth to death, it's only this. Don't seek any more for anything else by turning your head and revolving your brain. And then, as always happens in these stories, at these words, She was greatly enlightened. Reverend, from birth to death, it's only this. That's so startling that for me it makes a usually startling koan that's pretty well known a little less startling and somehow more patient. And this is the ordinary mind koan that in our Zendo we've taken up a few times, and it's familiar to many of you. So this is when Zhao Zhou, the great teacher who is the guy with the dog, you know, does the dog have Buddha nature, he's still a student of Nanchuan's. Zhao Zhou asked Nanchuan, what is the way? Nanchuan said, ordinary mind is the way. Should I try to turn toward it? If you try to turn toward it, you move away from it. How can I know the way if I don't turn toward it? The way has nothing to do with knowing or not knowing. Thinking you know is delusion. Thinking you don't know is blankness. When you truly reach the way, it's as vast as space itself. How could we talk about it in terms of it's this or it isn't this? And then again with these words, Zhao Zhou suddenly understood. Just parenthetically, it's not the point I want to make, but the koans are often kind of acerbic. And so Wu Men says after that, you know, after Zhao Zhou was suddenly enlightened or suddenly understood, he says, be that as it may, it'll take him 30 more years before he really gets it. Anyway, so in the ordinary mind koan, you don't have to turn any place else. As soon as you turn towards something else, you've already missed it. It's right here, or properly, it's right there. So there's a riddle here, and that's how do you practice if it's already right here? And like many koans, I think, this koan has both a practice point, you know, how do you practice, and a dharma point. So what's the deep truth that's lurking within this koan and this way of practicing? I think the practice point relies on the fact that one meaning of the way or path or Dao is just the ordinary Chinese term, apparently, for a passageway or corridor. And I know that from Joan, I think. So sort of taking the sometimes abstruse Indian teachings, the Chinese to sit, oh, you know, a path that you might walk along. And so that seems very practical and down to earth and might be speaking about method. And so the method then is there's no need when you come to a retreat to take up some special state of mind, as Suzuki Roshi says, to take up this practice or to take up this posture is already to assume the right state of mind. So I think as a practice point, that's important for the retreat. You don't need to be doing anything else with your practice other than sitting down. and seeing where your mind goes. Right? John Tarrant, who's Joan Sutherland's teacher and partner in crime in the Pacific Zen School, says sometimes, just take up your meditation where you are, then you won't be fighting yourself. I think that's great advice for a retreat. I think the koan's a little stranger than that, though, because there's also a Dharma point. And so ordinary mind is the way is telling us not only how to practice, but it's telling us something pretty strange and startling about the relation between the way and our minds. And so we know that Tao, as well as being a path or a corridor, is also the flow of the entire universe itself. Another koan that Joan really likes, and I'm blanking on the teacher, so I apologize, but there's a Roshi who's old and sick, and a student comes in, and I can't really imagine asking this, but the student says, on the whole, would your reverence prefer to live or to die? And the teacher just goes, Tao! You know? And so that's that force of that moving through everything is the Tao. And so the point of the koan, if it says ordinary mind is the Tao, is rather startling, because it's suggesting that not only that ordinary stuff out there, the rabbit scuttling across the scrub cactus or the tree moving in the breeze, but also your ordinary mind in a retreat or out of a retreat, your own thoughts moving, are also already the movement of the Tao in its most local and intimate version. So that creates some problems of its own. If ordinary mind is already the Tao, aren't we always already in ordinary mind? And again, what do we do then, and how do we practice with that? I think that's true, it would have to be true, but it's related to that Buddhist chestnut about original enlightenment. So they say that the Soto school emphasizes that everybody and everything is already enlightened already, whereas the Rinzai school, which we're maybe a little closer to, emphasizes that it's nevertheless important to have a realization experience. And as you remember, when the Buddha was enlightened, one of the things he said first is, all beings are enlightened already, only they don't realize it. And it's certainly true for me, I don't know about you, but I don't always feel that my own thoughts are themselves the Tao in that really big way. And so a question might be, why don't we feel that way? I think the broadest answer maybe is dukkha, which in our tradition we translate as unsatisfactoriness rather than suffering. My favorite formulation of dukkha, because it's so silly, Suzuki Roshi says someplace, maybe I should have gone to some other restaurant, which I think is discriminating. And John Tarrant says, also in a kind of funny way, he says, what is hell? Hell is just, this isn't it. So that's worth thinking about. So if we want things to be otherwise, we can work with that in a retreat. I think what's a little more close to the ordinary mind koan, though, and a little bit closer to the bone, at least for me, is wanting our own thoughts and feelings to be different and thinking they ought to be a different way. Larry Shainberg, in a book, Ambivalent Zen, quotes his Japanese teacher living in Soho, I think. Shainberg asks him, he says, well, at least if everybody doesn't get enlightened, doesn't Zen practice make people better? And the teacher just said, no, it makes them worse, which I don't think is really necessarily true, but there's all this stuff about gouging a wound in perfectly good flesh. So I wonder, you know, it seems to me it must be true outside in the rest of the world that people walk around discontented not only with, you know, some other restaurant, but with a movement of thoughts in their own mind. But it may be a malady to which Zen students are peculiarly liable, and it's certainly likely to come out in a retreat. Again, we have these notions about what should happen for us in a retreat, and so it's very, very common, I think, to be, you know, these are not the thoughts I should be thinking. I should be having deeper thoughts. I should be having more profound thoughts, and so on. And so I think the answer is that to the extent that you're shoving and pushing at your thoughts and you're angry at them and so on, it's really hard to perceive that those thoughts are themselves the movement of the Tao, even though in a strict sense and in a deep sense, they are. All those thoughts are just the movement of the way. And so the advice, which I guess would be obvious, is if you can stop pushing things around a little bit and just let them unfold, they'll take their course. If you don't think it's supposed to be this way, this is the way it should be in the retreat. It was this way yesterday. Why is it this other way now? Why is my mind restless? If you just leave that alone and let it flow, you're in the Tao. I think it's also true that as the kind of shoving yourself around abates a little bit, that you can feel things from time to time start to loosen. Your thoughts, your feelings move more freely. They're less constricted. And as you can stand back from, you know, getting involved with them so much and fighting with them, things begin to seem a little more spacious. It doesn't happen at every moment, and I think the more you demand that it happens, the less it happens. But if you're happy enough to go boing for a while, things at some point will quiet down, at least for a while. And at that point, I think something else comes into view. At least for me, one of the things that comes into view is kind of the middle distance, so that in addition to my thoughts, there are things that aren't exactly thoughts. They're sounds, they're sensations, they're things going on in the field around me. And awareness of those, which is enabled by my thoughts getting more spacious, in turn makes that field more spacious. And then I think it's pretty common in a retreat, at least for a while, also as that happens, for that really big background to come into view. So behind that field or inside that field and throughout it, where the bird is calling and the cactus is moving in the breeze, a truck is, you know, down the road away, then there's this big stillness behind it. And I think one of the remarkable things, and it's kind of in line with what I've been saying, is that the foreground does not have to be a certain way for that to happen. If you're just not fighting with it, it might be pretty quiet, it might be fairly busy, and right in the midst of that, and right up through it, this big embracing silence and stillness can materialize. So it's really not necessary to shove your thinking around too much to allow that to happen. It'll happen anyway. So here's this beautiful passage from Suzuki Roshi, which really does talk about moments of difficulty and doesn't see them as an impediment. To live in the realm of Buddha nature means to die as a small being, moment after moment. When we lose our balance, we die, but at the same time, we also develop ourselves, we grow. Whatever we see is changing, losing its balance. The reason everything looks beautiful is because it is out of balance, but its background is always in perfect harmony. This is how everything exists in the realm of Buddha nature, losing its balance against the background of perfect balance. So if you see things without realizing the background of Buddha nature, everything appears to be in the form of suffering. But if you understand the background of existence, you realize that suffering itself is how we live and how we extend our life. So in Zen, sometimes we emphasize the imbalance or disorder of life. And I think when you can do that, then whatever's arising in the foreground, whatever's coming into your mind, can sometimes really seem to you to be exactly Tao, to be exactly the local unfolding of the Tao, and to be a manifestation of that great stillness. And we can see that stillness and feel it holding everything, including us and our thoughts. And in that moment, nothing has to be any different than it is. I think that's close to Tori Zenji saying in the Bodhisattva's Vow, in every moment and every place, things can't help but shine with this light. And part of what I'm suggesting, of course, is that will come and it'll go. So what's right effort in this context? How do we practice? Clearly, sometimes we have to do a little something. We have to take some steps to encourage or allow the shoving and the ranting to settle down just a little bit to get the ball rolling. And we all have our own techniques for this. I'll just say quickly that sometimes mindfulness practice is useful, just watching those thoughts. And sometimes a concentration practice can do something like, for me, the metaphor would be, I've somehow taken the elevator down to another floor where it's kind of quieter. So if you want to, you know, do that concentration practice, that's fine. I want to encourage you for the retreat, though, to pay some attention to the notion that sometimes effort itself can turn into another form of pushing things around. And sometimes it's better just to be patient, watch things unfold, and let them rise and let them fall. And partly that means that in the foreground, the spirit with which we practice is the spirit of not knowing is most intimate, that's the spirit that you ride the retreat through. And I think that's also true with the big picture, that our relation to the Tao or to emptiness or the vastness or the stillness is also not knowing is most intimate. The way has nothing to do with not knowing. When you finally get there, it's as vast as space itself. How can we say of this, it's this or it isn't this? And as Joan says, when our ideas about the vastness fall away, then what comes walking toward us is itself it. So my suggestion for the retreat is that when in doubt, hold off a little, don't steer. Sometimes meddling really is just meddling, and just see where things go. And it's most important to be gentle and soft and kind to yourself as you do that. and the extent to which you can stop correcting yourself is to some measure the extent to which you'll have a good retreat. John Terrence's pithy version of that is, don't beat yourself up, it's just more of the same old shit. So at a certain point, something else really does take over from time to time. And here's Suzuki on that. He starts by talking about other people, but he'll get around to you in a second and to me. Even though you try to put people under some control, it is impossible. You cannot do it. The best way to control people is to encourage them to be mischievous. Then they will be in control in its wider sense. To give your sheep or cow a large, spacious meadow is the way to control him. So it is with people. First, let them do what they want and watch them. This is the best policy. To ignore them is not good. That is the worst policy. The second worst is trying to control them. The best one is to watch them, just to watch them, without trying to control them. The same way works for you yourself as well. If you want to obtain perfect calmness in your zazen, you should not be bothered by the various images you find in your mind. Let them come and let them go. Then they will be under control. But this policy is not so easy. It sounds easy, but it requires some special effort. How to make this kind of effort is the secret of practice. Suppose you are sitting under some extraordinary circumstances. If you try to calm your mind, you will be unable to sit. And if you try not to be disturbed, your effort will not be the right effort. The only effort that will help you is to count your breathing or to concentrate on your inhaling and exhaling. We say concentration, but to concentrate your mind on something is not the true purpose of Zen. The true purpose is to see things as they are, to observe things as they are, and to let everything go as it goes. This is to put everything under control in its widest sense. Zen practice is to open up our small mind, so concentrating is just an aid to help you realize big mind. So bodhisattvas, from birth to death, it's only this. Thank you.